2005 Sunstone Symposium West presents Session 41, A Philosophical Testimony, a presentation by Gerald E. Jones, with a response by J. Frederick Toby Pingree.
Okay. All right, we need to get started. They've started the recording, so I figure we should start the session. My name's Lee Paulson, and this is Session 41, A Philosophical Testimony. By Gerald Jones with a respondent, Toby Pingree. So if you're in the correct session. Also, if you have a question during the question answer period, as I'm sure you've been told all day today, come up to the mic to say the question into the mic so it can get on the recording. I'll just read to you a little bit about from the biography of Gerald Jones. That he was born in Gettysburg, South Dakota, and I know that he has like multiple degrees, ending with a PhD that had something to do with animals, right? Let's see if I can find it here. Yes, Concern for Animals in Five American Churches. I know this because he was my favorite institute director through all of my college career, which was pretty long. And and he's great. But I know that he knows a lot about religion and animals. I think he knows what every religion's doctrine about animals is. And you just published a book, because I bought it a few years ago. Brother Jones, didn't you? Mm-hmm. You published a book on animals, right?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah, here it is. Animals and the Church, 2003. So you can read about it in there. And he's been an institute director at a bunch of famous colleges. Oh, yeah, here they are. Berkeley, Stanford, and Yale.
Don't forget the University of Wyoming.
Oh, University of, okay. here it is, University of Wyoming. Okay, I knew about the other three. Yeah. Well, I just knew about those. I was waiting for him to go to Harvard after Yale, but I guess he retired instead, so. And then the respondent is Toby Pingree, who you should know because he speaks at Sunstones a lot, and he's the chairman of the Sunstone Board of Directors. And his bio says that he is a semi-retired CPA in Salt Lake City. So, and if he wants to add more, he can. And so I'll turn the time over to Brother Jones, and then and it'll take about maybe 40 minutes, and then I'll probably leave some minutes, and then there'll be time for question and answers, maybe.
They asked me how long this would be, and I said, well, a regular class period. I first gave this talk at San Anselmo Seminary for the Baptist Church, the Golden Gate Seminary, Theological Seminary. It was a group of about 35 or so Baptist theological students who were studying the cults. And the professor was very open-minded and very good in that instead of giving his view of it, he asked for it to come from some representative of the cult he was discussing. And so I developed this especially for that audience, which I thought would be fair and not controversial, but clear in showing the distinction between our beliefs and other beliefs. And it seemed to go fairly well. I had good questions, and the professor invited me back the following year to do the same thing again to a new class of students. Then institute director up at Fairfield asked me to present it to his students. And I haven't, I've given it to a couple of local classes once in a while. But I think I felt like it was time to, I won't say coming out of the closet, but I feel like it's time to open up this discussion to more people, and that this would be a fine opportunity to do that. So, it's a little philosophical, My degree was in history and philosophy of religion, but my minor was in philosophy for all three of my degrees. And some of those experiences were quite interesting. I started out on my PhD work at the University of Minnesota. They had an excellent philosophy department, but in talking with them after my summer session there, which I enjoyed, I realized I took Minnesota because it was close to home in South Dakota, and I could relate to it a little bit. And I served my mission in that mission field too. But then I knew ahead of time that they were really famous for the philosophy of science. And in talking to my professors about what I was interested in, they frankly told me that they didn't think I'd be too comfortable there, that I ought to find another graduate school where I could study more religion plus philosophy. And they recommended, and after I looked around, I decided the University of Iowa was ideal, because they had an excellent school of religion, the only state university at the time in the United States that had a separate school of religion. And the Jewish professor had to be ratified by the Jewish community. The Catholic professor had to be ratified by the local bishop, and so forth, so that you got the real feel for the religions. Plus, the philosophy department was really good. Gustav Bergman was there, who was a member of the Vienna Circle, who was a world-renowned philosopher who is really up to date. And anyway, those experiences I needed to give as background for here. I started out at the University of Utah as a freshman, and I took philosophy classes there from Waldemar Reed and another fellow that I can't remember. And then went on my mission, came back, and while I was gone, the BYU had hired Truman Madsen, Chauncey Riddle, and David Yarn, and had developed a real fine philosophy department, and so I transferred to there. Let me begin by, and I think you can hear without the microphone.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
They want to record it.
Okay.
Yeah,
I will hold it.
Record it.
Yeah. I will hold it so
long
you can hear.
Maybe what I have to do is,
I will be your traveling mic.
Okay, I can hold it. I can hold it. Epistemology is the study of learning how to learn things. And basically, there are three ways of learning. Some people give more, and I'll explain that here in a minute. One is what we call the rational, logic, reason, etc. The other one is empirical, the five senses. You can see it, touch it, feel it, so forth. And then this one is the interesting one down here, the intuitive or mystical, or we would say revelatory methods of learning. There are some people who stick with just one, but they're very rare. In other words, there are some people who things just have to be rational. Berkeley is named after Bishop Berkeley, who was a rationalist. He believed everything had to be centered in the mind and to be logical. And people would argue with him, and they said, well, what about the five senses? And they'd have him kick a rock. And he'd say, well, that's all in my mind. It doesn't really exist. There's no matter out there. Everything's up here. But people like him are different. Most people, as a matter of fact, in the world, combine these two. And I didn't make my circles very good here, but I'll put this where those two join together. This would be in that category here too. they use both the five senses and reason. The best example of that, I think, is dialectical materialism, the communist view. Dialectical, the rational logic. Materialism, the matter. You put the two together and you can explain the world and everything that goes on in it, so to speak. So I'll just put dialectical materialism as an abbreviation there. And then we have some pragmatism is sometimes used. The scientific method, where you come up with a theory and then you try to get the evidence to support it, or you get the evidence and then you try to come up with a theory to explain what you found. So many, many people in the world fall into this category. Now, there are even a few religions that fall into this category. Sometimes the Unitarian Universalist would fall into that category. They tend to deny this mystical revelatory things, and some of the more liberal Protestants could fall into that category as well. Then you have people who are in this category who combine the rational with the mystical. As far as religions are concerned, Roman Catholics would be a prime example of that. Systematic theology of St. Thomas Aquinas, but they also have a lot of mysticism and a lot of revelation that are involved. There's a denial to a great degree to the material world. As a matter of fact, the ideal for a good Catholic is to deny the material world and concentrate all of your thought on God with the mind and the spirit connecting. There are a lot of mystics in the Catholic Church. It's better to, well, they're very Platonic in that sense, too. Plato, remember, had this where matter was at the bottom and basically is considered kind of evil, and you get up here to the top where the ideal good is spirit or mind only. And that's why God cannot have a physical body, because that's negative. It would be bad for God to have a material body. And it's better to be celibate and not have a family. But if you're weak and can't avoid it, then you can get married, and they can make a sacrament out of marriage too. But that's the category that they're in. Religiously. The same would be true, of course, of the Hindus and Buddhists and Jains, etc. They would fall into that category, a denial of the empirical to the acceptance of the rational and the intuitive. Now, over here, you have people who generally use these two in connection with one another. Religiously, a classic example would be the Amish. And some fundamentalist Pentecostals, Jehovah's Witnesses, who tend to downplay reason. They discourage people from getting an education above the ability to read and write. I mean, that's okay. But to go to college and to receive a college degree, or especially a graduate degree, you could almost be excommunicated from some of those churches because they realize how dangerous that is to their faith. They tend to put that down. Well, I should have mentioned over here that a classic example of this rational and mystical would be the Christian Scientists, who also, see, don't go to doctors usually because you can fix things in your mind. You don't do it on the physical. You try to avoid the connection with the physical world. Now, what have I done here? This situation right here needs corrected. Now, in other words, some of these people, truth would be here for them, and truth would be here for these people, and truth would be here for these people, but I'm putting those as small t's, and what I want to do is talk about Mormonism, the gospel, in connection with these Venn diagrams, and say that as far as we're concerned, my feeling is the truth, with a capital T, is verified by all three methods. Verifiable by all three methods. If it isn't, we don't know for sure. You can have questions. There are a lot of things that we don't know physically. We haven't seen God or touched him. Some of the apostles did after the resurrection. But we just take the word of others, testimony of others in that process, until we do it, until we experience it physically, we can have questions.
Would Sterling McMurrin's philosophy fit into that?
Pardon?
Sterling McMurrin?
Yes. Sterling was, he had some real problems down here. But he would definitely fit up there. Actually, let me say that I think in the church we have people who are coming at the truth from all of these angles. We have people who try to combine these two but who question reason. I think of an old movie that had featured Henry Eyring's The Scientist. And it showed him growing up in Arizona as a young boy, and he was going away to college to study chemistry. And his aunt, I think it was, called him aside and said, "Don't go. You're going to lose your testimony. You shouldn't go to college and study the sciences because it's dangerous." She was coming at it, you see, from this angle over here, and really questioned higher education. There are some anti-intellectuals in the church, people who are anti-reason. And then you have, well, you have people in all categories coming from different aspects of life who look at it. So I think we need to understand our neighbor, that they may be looking at things from a little different angle than we do. Now, I'd like to comment on the Word of Wisdom as a good example. The Word of Wisdom came about because of an empirical problem of tobacco juice on the floor in a smoke-filled room. And Emma complained to Joseph about this situation. He went to the Lord. He got a revelation coming here to answer this kind of a problem. Since that time, things changed. Some of the first arguments for the Word of Wisdom, Leonard Arrington pointed this out, was an economic interpretation. And Brigham Young's argument for keeping the Word of Wisdom was a rational one. Why spend money on something that's not good for you when you can use that money to build temples and to build up Zion? The first arguments for the Word of Wisdom were rational, really. But I think the Word of Wisdom can stand the test of time, and at least to me, I feel like I've had a spiritual confirmation, I feel that it's very logical, but I also feel there's all kinds of empirical evidence to support my belief in the word of wisdom as a revelation from God. I think all three things come into play. There may be a lot of other principles that act the same way. Okay, enough on that, I think. I'm going to switch gears. Let me just say, in the process, that in talking to those ministers and prospective ministers, they could understand where Mormons were coming from, and that we weren't quite nincompoops, superstitious people following blindly some cultish fad of a religion. They could see that at least we could explain it in a way that they could understand, and they could put themselves into that picture and recognize that, yes, they fit into that category as well, to some degree. Now, to move on to the next category, I want to go to Sterling McMurrin, whom I never had a class from. I did hear him lecture a time or two, but I never had a class from him. I've read most everything he's written, and I was very impressed by his 8th Reynolds lecture, which was given at the University of Utah. And it was called The Patterns of Our Religious Faiths. And on the first couple of pages, he develops this concept where I take a little liberties with it, and I would like to explain that as I go along. He talks, first of all, about optimism and pessimism. And he relates the philosophies and religions of the world as to whether they're optimistic or pessimistic in relation to two things, either the ultimate view of things or the proximate view of things, the here and now. Now, I'm going to have to erase those again. This is a pretty small board. And point out that there's 4 possibilities. You can have a proximate optimism, and an ultimate pessimism. You can have a proximate pessimism and an ultimate optimism. Let me just talk about those before I move on to the other two possibilities. With a proximate optimism and an ultimate pessimism, he calls that humanism, where he's optimistic about this world and our existence as people, but there's no life after death. Where ultimately it's pessimistic. When we're dead, we're dead. There's a zero ultimately. So if we're going to have things good, we've got to do it here and now. And if we just all get together, we can work it out, and we can have heaven on earth. But that's the only one you're going to see, because there isn't going to be one afterwards. Now, proximate pessimism is the other way around. Let's see, I'll put this down. He called these, they were liberals or humanists, in that category. This one, proximate pessimism, we're living in hell. We're in a bad way. Things are going to the dogs. But just wait. As the old Bob Dylan song said, just wait for the pie in the sky hereafter. Workers of the world unite. You can put up with all this garbage here now, but pay me $5 and you can go to heaven later on. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of religions that fall into that way. Traditional Christianity would fall into this category. But in a way, so would the Hindu, Buddhist, and other religions fall into that category too. This material world, we can't wait to get out of here, because once we get out of here, then we'll be free, we'll be able to enjoy things as things go on there. Okay, now I'll go to the other two possibilities, which are pretty easy to figure out. We've got proximate pessimism and ultimate pessimism. McMurrin identifies these as existentialist. Now that's a little broad, because we do have some religious existentialists who are a little more optimistic about some things. But this is, well, I should have mentioned on the approximately pessimistic on the other one, too, that see, man is born evil, man's born a sinner, and unless we're saved by the grace of God, we're all going to go to hell. That's proximate pessimism for a lot of religious people. So we wait till we get to the other side. But we're living in the fallen world and there's not much hope for us. But here, I like the best example of the combination is Jean-Paul Sartre, who wrote a play called No Exit. He says, we're living in hell and there's no way out. Things are bad here and it can't get any better. Just, you can either commit suicide or just lump it and live through it, suffer through it, that's it. And there are a lot of people, these are the people who jump off the bridge, a lot of them, commit suicide because they just can't put up with this garbage anymore and they're not worried about what's going to happen to them hereafter. They're just getting out of it, just avoiding everything. So there are people in that category. The other one, of course, is proximate optimism and ultimate optimism. Now there are some liberal Christians, and McMurrin talks about them, who the Unitarian Universalist would fall into that category, where they believe people are good and they can be happy, and it's a universal salvation. There is no hell. Everybody's going to be saved. If they do, you don't have to believe in heaven, and a lot of those people don't believe in life after death even, but if they do, it's all positive. But my contention is that the Latter-day Saints fit that category better than any other people. Let me explain why. We believe that man is that he might have joy, women too. And everybody on this earth, we can have Zion here. We can have a Zion community. It's possible if we can clean up our act and get there. People are basically good. We're not born evil, as the article of faith says. We believe that men are punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression. It's just for us to make that decision. We have a positive view of people. We are children of God, the primary song. I am a child of God, and our potential. Now the potential is interesting, in my view. A lot of people don't recognize this, but we're more Unitarian or Universalist than most people. Whoops. Thank you. Than most people want to admit. We've got the celestial, terrestrial, telestial and outer darkness. We hardly put anybody here. Hardly, you've got to work hard to get there. You cannot get to outer darkness without a lot of trouble, without a lot of work, with a lot of going up and down, ending up down, but having a lot of ups to begin with, so a lot of disappointments of some kind or another. Don't forget that even the telestial kingdom is considered a heaven, and that it is a good place. And who goes there? Murderers, adulterers, liars, and thieves still go to a place where they will no longer suffer physically, nor will they suffer mentally, because they wouldn't be there if they didn't want to be there. If they wanted to be someplace else, they would be someplace else, because you're judged by what you want and what you desire. Birds of a feather flock together, and if you're more comfortable with that kind of people, that's where you want to associate with. They can't judge you, they won't judge you as being bad, because they're just like you are. You can just swap stories with one another. You can't progress maybe very much, but I'm not so sure about that either. You might be able to progress a little bit, and whatever you want to do, you can do. Don't forget that the terrestrial kingdom is made up of good people, honest, faithful believers who do not commit sins will go to the terrestrial kingdom. That takes care of all kinds of Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Jehovah's Witnesses, Baha'is, Catholics, you name it. There's all kinds of those people that we put into exactly the kind of heaven they expect to go to. They don't expect to see God, and the scriptures tell us they won't, because he has a body. They'll see Christ. Christ will go to the terrestrial kingdom and rule over them. They expect that. They aren't disappointed. They don't want any more than that. That's all they expected. It's going to be better than what they expected, in my view of things. So we're very ultimately optimistic, not only about ourselves. Who can be more optimistic than to believe that you can become as God is, that you can become perfect? That's as ultimately optimistic as anybody. That's where we're considered heretical. That's why a lot of people don't like us, because we think too much of that. We think that that's possible. That's heresy. But not only us, but everybody else too. In other words, we're optimistic not only about ourselves, but we're optimistic about everybody in the whole world, the world itself included. So my experience in talking to people of other denominations, and in talking to some philosophy classes, I had some very interesting experience. I'd be asked to come and guest different philosophy classes in colleges around the Bay Area here and in other places too. And I began, after I explained how I could believe what I believe, I recognized that my view of things was as logical and as verifiable as anything that they were putting up as a comparison, as an option. As a matter of fact, I think ours is more logical. I think it's more empirically verifiable, and that it's definitely more spiritually, because we believe in revelation, than theirs, who don't even believe that they can have a modern revelation to really confirm them. So I think that I was standing on pretty firm ground. And when some of them would push me and say, well, how do you know that? I say, I don't really know it for sure that I can prove it to you, but I know it as well as I know anything, because I know that my senses can deceive me. I took enough psychology classes to know that your eyes are very deceptive. There's a blank spot, as you know, when the rays go back into your retina, they cross over. So what does your mind do? It fills in the blank. And you see things that you really don't see. And then I had experiences where you put on glasses that turned everything upside down. If you wait a day, your mind corrects that. And you start seeing things right side up, even though the glasses have turned things upside down. You take the glasses off, things are upside down again in reality. And it takes you a little while for your mind to adjust to that. So you have to question your eyes. You have to question your sense of feel. You have to question your sense of taste. You have to question your sense of smell. It may not be accurate. The measurements you use in the lab, you have to have faith in that. And that's one thing I'd like to think about all the time. I want to close with is a classic statement by Chauncey Riddle, one of my favorite professors at DeWay. He gave this as an address to Seminary and Institute teachers at the BYU in June 1962. Let's see. This is important because of the wildly touted false notion that when a man acts on the basis of science, he knows what he is doing, whereas in religious matters, he acts only on faith. Listen to this strong sentence. This insidious bit of intellectual hypocrisy needs to be exposed, and the mind of every intelligent person disabused of it. He got his PhD in the science, the philosophy of science at Columbia University. He knew what science was all about. That's what he got, went to the university for. He realized that they had to have faith in their theories and in their evidence. Let us again reemphasize the basis of all human action is a hope that the intellectual tools we believe in will enable us to anticipate the future correctly and to be able to accomplish the fulfillment of our desires. And to close, a classic statement by Joseph Smith from the Lectures on Faith. If men were to duly consider themselves and turn their thoughts and reflections to the operations of their own minds, they would readily discover that it is faith only which is the moving cause of all action in them, that without it, both mind and body would be in a state of inactivity, and all their exertions would cease, both physical and mental. That's the faith I have. I have to have that. I have to have faith in something, or I wouldn't exist, or there wouldn't be any reason to exist. And why not have faith in the things that give me the most support in the faith that I'm aiming for? I get upset sometimes with people standing up and saying, I know that the church is true, and it's the only true church. Well, I can't do that. I avoid that. If pushed, I say, I know it as well as I know anything. And nobody can or has been able to, and I've talked to all kinds of people on all kinds of levels, tried to argue with me that I shouldn't believe and have faith in what I believe in. But I'm convinced that the gospel is true and that I have faith in it and know it as well as I know anything. Like Joseph Smith said, if we don't have faith in our memory, if we don't have faith in our mental ability, if we don't have faith in our physical, if we don't have faith in whatever, we wouldn't progress. Well, I hope I'm somewhere within the time limit. I haven't bothered to look. Some questions. You want to take over, Toby? Okay. Yeah, give her your response.
It's a real privilege to share the podium with Gerald. We both lived in the East Bay for a long time, and we used to, in the last years of teaching at the Institute at Diablo Valley College, why we'd have an evening sort of seminar and go over and listen to him sort of ruminate about his life's experiences and so on, and it was, I enjoyed that too, and it was marvelous to be with someone who, I think he portrayed today that, you know, we have several models in the church of people who can expound where the church stands and what it is and so on. There are those, and we're exhorted to be this sort of a defender of the faith, which show by fervent testimony what it's all about. And we hear talk in general conference occasionally about this. That's what we're to be doing. And I think Gerald, in his own way, is a defender of the faith, but not because he is loudly exclaiming it, but he's presenting it in a way that is very rational and defendable and understandable. There are those who would say that we need to, follow the prophet. That's the way. What's said out there is the way to guide us, and that's how we pick up our direction and do that. And I don't think Gerald would say we shouldn't follow the prophet, but I think he should say that whatever the prophet says should be judged by other standards as well. And who? And he's a master communicator, a bridge builder, a practical, rational, intellectual about things. And I thought those Venn diagrams, is that the circles? He referred me to an article that he wrote. 1980, that's got to be 25 years ago. I didn't know you were that old, but that's 25 years ago, which essentially says he had written down what he said there about these three circles and how they join together. And I'm really very comfortable with that because a church to me, if it doesn't work, it ain't right, which is sort of the empirical side of things. You look at it, does it work? And I think that our church does work. Yeah, it doesn't work always in every way, but by and large, it really works. You can see what happened. They built the West, and we're spreading throughout the world and so on. It's rational. Yeah. It's a lot of thinking about it and hearing and talking to people like Gerald and Marion Hanks and reading John Whitslow says it's rational. And then along comes the mystical or the spiritual, and that's, I think, the least subject to any kind of outside confirmation. It's really what happens to you or not. There are all kinds of people in the world who have mystical, spiritual experiences about a lot of things that don't make any sense to me and don't fit, but I think when that mystical experience is combined with the rational, with the empirical, why then it does make sense. And so I've appreciated his approach to that, and I think he's a marvelous representative to deal with other people. I can see him talking to these fundamentalist Christians or whoever they were, and none of them being offended by it, none of them wanting to take to the barricades and throw us out of Christianity when he talks, compared to what it would be if we were there trying to violently and in loud voices expound what we believe and proclaim the truthfulness of what our message is. But anyway, those would be my comments about it. Thank you, Gerald. As always, it's been wonderful hearing you.
Looks like we have 14 minutes left. So if there's any questions that you'd like to ask Brother Jones or Toby or both, if you would, ask your question in the microphone.
In your quoting Chauncey Riddle, it seemed to me the way he was talking, he eliminates one of these spheres, the rational sphere. Would you respond on that?
Well,
Did I lose it? Where I put it? I think you've got my other one too. Thank you. From what he said there, it does seem that way, all right. Except that one of the classes I took from Riddle was logic. He was an excellent logician. And so philosophically, he was very strong in reason and in making sure that arguments were logical and followed, didn't have some fallacy mixed in with them. But I can see what you're saying, that it seems to I think he's just pointing out, which all of us can do, is that there are weaknesses to all three of these. The weakness to the spiritual is we can have some weird spiritual experiences, people who claim to have some religious thing that really off the wall, because it doesn't add up to what we think reality is. And I already mentioned about the five senses, where we can deceive ourselves with feeling and touching. You touch ice that feels hot because, and it looks hot because there's steam coming off of it. But you put your hand on it, you feel like you're burning, but it really isn't. It's because it's cold. Or you can put a couple of pins in your back and it only feels like one because the nerves are so far apart that you can't tell that there's really two pin pricks there instead of just one. Anyway, there's all kinds of things in that. And this hearing is fantastic and everything, eyesight. But the same is true with reason. There can be all kinds of problems with reason and with the mind, and one of them is your memory. You have to be able to have faith in your memory of your rational process, or in how it works, or that the conclusion isn't some pipe dream. It's made out of thin air. And I think that's what Riddle is pointing out, that there are a lot of theories and reasoning going on out there that you also have to have faith in. In other words, you can't just use that as a sole measuring thing. So he's talking about the two, basically, the scientific method, but along with the thinking processes as well, that there are weaknesses there and you have to be able to support it. So maybe what this says here does seem to point that. But he does say that the mind of every intelligent person disabused of this wrong idea, so he does give them some credit for having intelligence and that they might be able to straighten things out. Yes.
I was interested in your comments about Henry Eyring because my husband got a PhD in chemistry at Berkeley, and I was introduced to him by Henry Eyring's youngest brother, youngest of 17 in that family. And when I first met my husband and after we got married, he kept saying to me, "Do you know that Leroy's oldest brother is one of the greatest scientists, chemists in the world? He was president of the American Chemical Society, president of the American Advancement for Science." And he said, "But he's active Mormon. He should get a Nobel Prize. He is so good." They felt he should have most of the chemists felt that he was denied a Nobel Prize. So how my husband never joined the church, and he died at an early age thinking that that was the end of it. He could not believe in. An agnostic, I guess, but he went to church with me and didn't drink and smoke and coffee or anything. But how do you tell somebody who says, how can Henry Eyring, you know, be a good Mormon and be the best chemist in the world? I mean, you must get students you've had like that. What do you tell them, other than what you told them?
Well, I think you've done a good job of it. He was able to put things together and was a very dedicated scientist. And I think it's easy, personally. I think it's easy to be the best in anything and be a Latter-day Saint. It takes some innate ability, however, and it takes a dedication to work and maybe a little other help besides. But I don't see anything, any reason why he couldn't. In other words, I really don't. Being an active member of the church, perfectly compatible. And I agree. I've heard other people say, Truman Madsen told me one time that he had evidence that's the only reason Henry Eyring did not receive a Nobel Prize was because he was a Mormon, that they didn't want to do it. Because I don't know what evidence. I didn't push Brother Madsen on that, but I feel like he must have had some evidence that that was the case. I don't think that had happened today. I think today they'd give it to him anyway.
Any other questions or comments or anything? I guess I just wanted to make a comment since there's a little bit of time. On this, I work at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, part of NASA down in Pasadena, and on your question, I remember going to this, we have famous people come all the time, and it's kind of this mutual admiration society. They come and they think, wow, you know, you've invited me, you know, you sent rovers to Mars and stuff, and you're letting me talk to you. And we're all going, oh, wow, you're the, you know, famous astronomer, you're talking to us, you know. And that's how it goes. So it's kind of fun. And this one astronomer, and I don't remember who it was exactly, but he's one of the big name ones. He runs several of the big telescopes. And he came and started giving a talk, and I went to listen to it because it was on, did he think we would ever find life on other planets? And you know, he gave all his reasoning behind it and stuff. And then at the end of the question and answer period, and during the course of his talk, it became apparent that he personally was an atheist, and he just assumed that everybody at JPL, because they were all scientists and engineers, were atheists too, of course. You know, it was really weird to hear him because, you know, I know for a fact working there that, I mean, I couldn't name a percentage, but maybe half are actively religious in various religions, you know, and it's not surprising. And the rest are mostly agnostic. I don't know if I even know anyone who's actually atheistic there. Anyway, there was this one question that was asked at the end, and, I mean, I could get into it. It was very interesting, but, and I wasn't a Mormon, but, when the guy asked it, and he was an older scientist who I know is one of the famous ones there, and the guy knew him, and as he asked this question, it became apparent as the guy looked out that, wait a minute, everybody there wasn't naturally atheist like himself. And his eyes started getting bigger as he realized everyone was eager for him to answer this question because it connected kind of like, well, you know, how does God fit into life on other planets and stuff like that, you know, and how old the universe is and stuff. And I was thinking, wow, that's a really cool question. And as he looked down, he could see that there was all these people that were eager. And then he actually stepped back from the microphone as this kind of shock came over him that all these hard scientists, you know, physicists and astronomers and, you know, we have everything. We have biologists and, you know, climatologists and stuff. were religious, you know. And so, I've never had this problem in my coursework that the more scientific you are, the less religious you could be or believing in religion. Anyways, I just thought, I don't know why they wouldn't give him these days, why they wouldn't give it to him. Anyway, I really personally appreciated having him as my institute director growing up. And you can see why from his ideas. If there's no other questions or comments, then we'll adjourn this session. Thanks.